dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The power of corporations to control or manipulate every aspect of our lives has led a growing number of people to identify the legal rights of corporations as one of the key obstacles to a democratic society. Tonight we'll look at what is called corporate personhood, what it means, how it came to be, and why some people have dedicated themselves to abolishing it. We'll begin with an interview conducted by Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters with Tom Hartman, author of Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights.
Let me start out and ask you, how is it that you came to write this book, Unequal Protection?
Well, I had written an earlier book called Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight about the wipeout of the of our ecology, about the kind of planet going down in flames and why. And I was looking a lot of the cultural stories that we tell ourselves. The culture is like the collection of stories that we all agree to pretend are real and behave as if they were. And I identified what I think are a lot of the toxic cultures in our story in that book, things like we're not part of nature, things that we inherited from Aristotle and Descartes. But I kept having this sense that there was something that I was missing, because, it's like if you did everything in that book, still there was this juggernaut that was eating the earth, this corporate juggernaut. And it was like, how did that come about? So I started digging into the writings of Thomas Jefferson, because I was fascinated by democracy. I mean, I grew up with democracy as this iconic thing, this extraordinary, wonderful, beautiful thing. Greece tried it for 200 years and got wiped out, Athens, and then Alexander the Great came in. This was almost 3,000 years ago. And then the second experiment in democracy was us, America. And we so inspired France that they, beheaded the king, and on it went. And reading Jefferson's letters, and he wrote 18,000 letters in his life, and I spent about a year reading as many as I could, probably 4,000 or 5,000 of them. And he kept referring to the three oppressors of men, the traditional oppressors of men. And of course, we all know about the two main ones. One was churches, popes, starting kings, the Crusades and the Inquisitions and whatnot, people who claimed that God told them to do it. And then there were the warlords, who were called kings and queens, who were just seized by brute force and held power by threat of violence. But there was a third one. It turns out that the Boston Tea Party, and I actually found a first person account published at the end of the 1700s, early 1800s, of the Boston Tea Party. There's 150 guys involved in that thing. They all swore an oath of silence. The only one we know for sure was Sam Adams, because he bragged about it, but everybody else was just silent about it. And this guy, George Robert Twelvetree Hughes, wrote a memoir that it was kind of lost to history, and I found the original version of it, and he described it in detail, and I've got big chunks of it in my book. And it turns out that the Boston Tea Party was not a revolt against England. I had learned in high school that the Boston Tea Party was because the Tea Act of 1773, they'd raised the tax on tea in the protest, the colonists' protest. Well, actually what had happened was in 1773 in the Tea Act, they eliminated the tax on tea for the East India Company, which at that time was the largest transnational corporation in the world, and thus allowing the East India Company to wipe out the thousands of small entrepreneurs up and down the East Coast who were importing tea. And this was a revolt against a transnational corporation, and that transnational corporation's influence of the British and the local American governments. It was the first WTO Seattle protest. Seriously, it was big time. And it's very clear when you read this, read his works, the actual writings from the 1700s, that's what these people were about. And so I kept running across Jefferson referring to this, and I kept running across Hugh, and then I found Hughes's book, and I read that, and I thought, okay, so you know, how did it get where it is today? You know, how did corporations, you know, acquire the power that they have when Jefferson was warning against it, and when the American Revolution was fought to throw off a transnational corporation in large part? And that's what led me to do the initial, you know, a couple of years of research that led to the book.
So we're now at a point where it appears that corporations have more rights than any other entity on the planet. It seems that they have the rights of people. They have these other bonus rights on top of that. How did that come to be?
Well, the conventional wisdom and what lawyers learn in law school, and most of our legislators are lawyers, and so they believe this to be true, is that in 1886 there was this Supreme Court case that prior to 1886, from the founding of the country and the writing of the Constitution, you know, in the late 1700s, 1780s, for 100 years, corporations were not persons. They were, well, they were called artificial persons because they had to be able to have some sort of status to be, to own land and pay taxes and things. But they were tightly controlled. There were laws in most states that said, for example, that if an officer of a corporation met with a politician and discussed the business of the corporation, that was considered undue influence and that person could go to prison. It was a felony. That if an officer of a corporation or a corporation gave money to a politician, that was called bribery and it was a felony. There are very specific laws concerning that if a corporation advertised in a way that tried to influence an electoral process, since corporations can't vote, they're not citizens, they have no right doing that, and they could lose their charters and be put out of business. There were all these laws that tightly constrained corporate activity. And the railroad corporations in the 1770s, 1780s and 1770s had become sort of like the computer industry of today. I mean, they came out of nowhere and became the largest and most powerful corporations in America in a period of just, you know, a generation. The Civil War really fueled their growth. And the story is that the railroads started, well, after the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed, which freed the slaves. You know, they gave them the right to vote, that provided against discrimination against them, and the 14th Amendment says that that all persons, regardless of their race, would have access to equal protection under the law. And the problem was that 14th Amendment didn't say all natural persons, because, see, at law back in those days, they referred to corporations as artificial persons and human beings as natural persons. It simply said all persons. Now, it starts out, all persons born in the United States are citizens of the United States. That's the first sentence of the 14th Amendment. So it's pretty clear that they're talking about human beings because they were born, you know, born or naturalized in the United States. But nonetheless, it says, you know, persons shall not have the right of equal protection abridged. So the railroads started, they were very upset about the fact that local communities were regulating their behavior. Railroads were in most places monopolies. In the big cities, of course, they'd join, but, you know, in most places there was just one railroad who ran through in entire states in many cases. And so the local communities would regulate how much they could charge, because back then the corporate laws were that all your books had to be open at all the time for the government, because the corporations are authorized by we the people, you know, by state governments. The word corporation doesn't exist in the Constitution because the founders wanted to make sure that something like the East India Company never rose again. And so they gave the power to regulate corporations to the states so that local folks could keep track of local activities. And the corporations, the railroads were real upset about this. And so they started taking these lawsuits before the Supreme Court saying, you know, you can't tax us at different prices in different counties. That's discrimination. You know, you can't have these different rules for us in different places. That's discrimination. And they used this Free the Slaves Amendment, claiming discrimination. Well, repeatedly throughout the 1770s, as they kept advancing this cause, the Supreme Court kept throwing them back, you know, kept throwing it back in their faces and saying, no, sorry, guys, you know, that's not the case. It's not why the 14th Amendment was passed. It was passed to free the slaves, pure and simple. And but finally, in 1886, the story goes that you'll hear in law school and that most people believe, and you'll find in a lot of books, corporations were given the rights of persons. The Supreme Court ruled that they were persons. That the 14th Amendment, because it failed to say natural persons, had to include corporations as well. Well, when I did the research. Excuse me. I wanted to read the decision, you know, because I'd read so much about it. So I went down to the, one of the neat things about living in Vermont is, like, you know, you can walk into the governor's office and he's sitting there at his desk going, "Hi, how are you?" And so I walked into the Supreme Court building, and the guy who runs the library there, Paul Donovan, I said, "Paul, I'm looking for this 1886 ruling." And so he takes me back into this old dusty stack of books, and he says, "Here's the original book published in 1889, you know, the U.S. reports," and this old creaky, cracky, you know, kind of falling apart thing. And I'm reading through the decision, and the decision says that it was a fence post case. This actual case, the railroad was saying that the state should have assessed the fence posts, but the county assessed the fence posts for tax purposes, and that was their main argument. And the court agreed with them. They said, "Yep, you know, the wrong person assessed the fence posts," and threw it back down to the lower court. So. And at the end of the decision, the court points out that there were a series of arguments made before the court, including the argument that corporations are persons, and that the court chose not to rule on any of these constitutional issues. So I'm reading the decision, and the decision says, this court never ruled that corporations are persons. So I went to Paul, and I said, "Paul, I'm missing something here, because I've been hearing, you know, and for 120 years, you know, it's a..." And Paul says, "Well, you know, I'm not a lawyer." He says, "But look at this part of it." And there's this little fine print at the front of the page before the decision. And the first sentence of the fine print says, "Corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment and entitled to equal protection under the law." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "That's the head note." He said, "That wasn't written by the Supreme Court. That was written by the reporter of the court, who was an employee of the banks and Biddle, I think, was the company, the publishing company in New York that publishes the book. And it's just, you know, a commentary." And I said, "Does it have the force of law?" And he said, "I don't think so, but you need to talk to the lawyer." So I made the copies of the thing, went around the corner to the office, walked down the street and around the corner to the office of Jim Ridfoe, who's an old friend of mine, who's a lawyer, you know, went to law school. Said, "You know, Jim, you know about the 1886 case?" And he, "Oh, yeah, that's when corporations became persons." And I said, "Well, here's the case." And I laid it out on his desk, you know, and I had highlighted these parts. I said, "Read it." He's reading it, and he goes, "Well, this isn't what we learned in school." And I said, "Now, look at the headnote." And he reads the headnote, and he goes, "Holy cow." Well, he was a little more expletive than that. And I said, "What happened?" And he said, "Well, this thing says clearly corporations are not persons, but the headnote says that they are." And he says, "The headnote's wrong." And I said, "Well, you know, how'd that happen?" And he said, "Well, there's mistakes in law books all the time." He said, "One of the first things they train lawyers in law school is not to read headnotes, because, you know, that's just a commentary. It's not legal." And I said, but you know, 120 years of American law have been based on this. You know, I was starting to sound hysterical, you know. And Jim is like, "Well, you know, these mistakes happen." He said, "But you need to talk to somebody who really knows constitutional law." So I got on the phone, and I called up the Secretary of State in Vermont, you know, and Deb Markowitz, who's the Secretary of State, and again, she answers her own phone. You know, "Hi there, Deb. And, you know, you don't know me, but I'm a writer and I'm working on this." And I told her the story of it. And she said, "Well, you know," she said, "headnotes don't have precedent. They are not law." She said, there was a 1905 Supreme Court case, in fact, in which the Supreme Court ruled that headnotes don't have law, don't have precedent. So the whole idea that corporations should be entitled to human rights, which is the important next step in our conversation, I think, was a lie. Turns out it was a lie. The whole thing, it was a theft. That's why I say the theft of human rights. Corporations stole human rights by co-opting the court reporter. Turns out the court reporter was a former president of a railroad, and he just wrote that in.
That is incredible. So, but it begs the question then of, so is everything that followed that then debatable now? I mean, can we fix it?
Well, yes and no. What happened was that there were several cases that followed this in the 1890s that referenced the headnotes in the 1886 case, but then continued to say the corporations are persons, therefore they should have rights to free speech, they should have rights to privacy, they should have rights to not have to self-incriminate, they should have rights to against discrimination. And once the Supreme Court, even though the basis of its ruling was wrong, once it ruled that this was the case, then that actually became the precedent. So it is the law of the land that corporations are persons, even though it's based on a lie, and the Supreme Court has never, ever had an argument about this before it in which it made a decision. And there's no legislation ever been passed, no president has ever talked about it. In fact, the presidents have said the exact opposite. You know, the presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower have warned us explicitly about the power of corporations being persons. So what happened was once corporations had this power, when Jefferson and Madison were putting together the Bill of Rights, what they wanted to do was build an absolute wall between government, which could live forever and could accumulate power and could potentially one day oppress its citizens because they had just overthrown such a government, between government on the one hand and the rights of individual citizens on the other hand. So they wanted to give this enormous club to the citizens so that they could beat back government if it ever became oppressive. And that club is the right of assembly, the right of free speech, the right not to incriminate yourself, the right to a trial by your peers, the right to privacy, and you know, the right against discrimination, which was passed after the Civil War, and what we call the Bill of Rights, you know, and the 13th, 14th, 15th, 15th Amendments. And prior to 1886, corporations didn't have access to those things because they're not human beings. You know, the logic was they can't vote, so why are they involved? They shouldn't be involved in the electoral process. They don't breathe fresh air. In fact, they're polluting our air, so we need to regulate their behavior so they don't ruin our air because we're biological systems. We need fresh air. They don't need water to drink. So, you know, there is employees of corporations, but the corporation itself is, you know, the legal entity. So once this 1886 non-ruling happened and was ratified in the 1890s, corporations very quickly started saying, okay, if we're persons, we should have the First Amendment right of free speech. We should be able to talk to politicians. And literally thousands of laws in states across the United States that had made it a crime for corporations to lobby politicians were struck down. Laws that made it a crime for corporations to give money to politicians were struck down. And corporations began to subsume the political process. There was a backlash to this in the early 1900s, the populist movement, which led to the passage of the 17th Amendment in 1912, which caused us to directly elect the Senate. Before that, the Senate was actually appointed by the state legislatures, and so it was, you know, kind of represented the wealthy and the powerful. But there's an interesting history there. But the point of it is that, so first of all, they started claiming First Amendment rights, and that, you know, kind of weaseled them into the political process, where they're well established now. That's why things like McCain-Feingold are so problematic. We can't control corporations, so McCain-Feingold regulates politicians instead of corporations. I mean, that's what we're left with. You know, it's this weakness. They used corporate personhood. They said, you know, we should have the Fourth Amendment right to privacy, and there was a famous chemical company that the EPA wanted to check out, that they were, you know, polluting the environment. There was a whistleblower, and the EPA came in and said, we want to check your factory. And the chemical company said, nope, we have the Fourth Amendment to privacy. You can't do that. So the EPA flies a small plane over the factory and takes pictures. And the chemical company took that all the way to the Supreme Court, and the court ruled, hey, companies have the right to privacy. Similarly with OSHA. OSHA inspectors have been locked out of corporate offices. They can't inspect the workplace. Unions are, you know, going crazy about this, but this is, and unions, by the way, are not persons under the law, although corporations and humans are. Strange, bizarre thing here, but that's a whole other topic. And so the right of privacy has allowed them to, for example, allowed the tobacco companies to hide what they knew since the 1930s about the addictive and deadly potentials of nicotine, and on it goes. And it's what's being used now. You know, corporations claim trade secrets, you know, so that they don't, you know, a lot of the Enron thing was possible because corporations were able to hide their crimes behind the Fourth Amendment shield of privacy. Fifth Amendment, the takings clause, the double jeopardy clause, and the right against self-incrimination. Again, oh, we don't have to talk about the fact that we know that we're committing crimes because that would be self-incrimination. And the 14th Amendment, the Penny Corporation, J.C. Penney, sued the state of Florida back in the 1930s, saying that it was illegal discrimination, that in Florida, as in every other state in the country, there were laws that encouraged small local businesses and made it more difficult and more expensive for large out-of-state corporations to operate in those states. And it was, you know, for obvious reasons. They wanted to keep the community intact and the local businesses intact. Penny came in and said this is unconstitutional discrimination under the 14th Amendment, which was designed to free the slaves. You're discriminating against us as if we were, you know, black people or, you know, freed slaves. And the Supreme Court said, well, I guess if in 1886 they said they're persons, then they must be right, and they agreed with them. And that's why it's so hard for communities to keep out Walmarts and things like that now. So we have this original theft of human rights. And now, once this enormous club that was, you know, appropriately given to humans to constrain government, that government should be, as Lincoln said, of the people, by the people, for the people, that this enormous club to keep government at bay that was given to we humans was given to corporations. With their enormous power, they've used it to co-opt our governmental process and essentially seize control of our governments. An interesting anecdote or an interesting footnote on this is that this happened in 1886, right, theoretically. In 1872, another group of people came before the Supreme Court and said, we'd like to be people. That was women, the Bradville versus Illinois case. And the court said, nope. Women are not persons. In fact, they ruled that the sole and pervading purpose of women was to be a wife and helpmate to their husbands, and that they had no legal status independent of their husbands. Then in 1896, freed slaves. A guy named Plessy, the son of a slave, hopped on a railroad car, went in the white compartment, got thrown off, got on, got thrown off, got on, got arrested, took it to the Supreme Court, Plessy versus Ferguson case. And said, you know, we'd like to be persons too. After all, the amendment was passed for us. And the Supreme Court said, no, we don't think so. And instituted apartheid in the United States, segregation, which... Now, the good news is that in 1954, in Brown versus Board of Education, the court reversed itself in the Plessy case and said, gee, we made a mistake. I guess, you know, non-whites, you know, African-Americans and other people who are of not just, you know, white European ancestry should be persons in the United States. And in 1973, in Roe v. Wade, the court said, you know, gee, we made a mistake in the Bradwell case in 1872, and women should be persons. They should have the Fourth Amendment right to privacy. So it's possible that the court could reverse itself and say, you know, we made a mistake. Corporations, you know, they can't breathe. They're not alive. They're not human beings. So why are we giving them human rights? And that's my hope, that this can be changed.
There are some people who have said that the whole creation of the United States was to formulate a country that would be perfect for corporations, perfect for large companies. Mm. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, that was the big dynamic tension between the Federalists, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, John Adams, and what came to be called the Democratic Republicans, which we now call the Democratic Party. And the Federalists kind of died out and then got reincarnated as the Republican Party just before the Civil War. And that tension... I think that it was good intentions on all part. Alexander Hamilton and John Adams really believed that if the United States was going to be powerful enough to fight back the imperial European forces, because Spain and France and England still had a toehold on North America, that if we were going to be powerful enough, we had to have these big corporations. The first battle was over the Bank of the United States. Hamilton wanted to create a federal bank that could, you know, take the state's debts from the Revolutionary War and pay them back. And so they had this vision of this huge industrial America. Jefferson and Madison and Monroe, on the other hand, had this vision of, well, America might move in that direction, but we have to be very, very careful that nothing like the East India Company ever rises again, where we've got a corporation so large that it can influence government and that it can overwhelm local communities. And that's why they fought so hard to include in the Bill of Rights an 11th Amendment that would ban corporate monopolies. Of course, they lost. You know, I mean, the ghost of Thomas Jefferson has to be sitting around right now going, I told you so, told you so. But I think that in both cases, they believed that was the best thing for the country. I don't see villains here. I just see differences of opinion. You read the Federalist Papers, it's pretty obvious that's what was going on.
So tell us about what's being done about this. Are there any inspiring examples that you can give us to change things back to the way they once were, perhaps?
Well, it's incredible as people are hearing about this, you know, as the result of a small number of organizations are starting to wake up. Parts of the Green Party are starting to talk about this in Arizona, in particular. The Greens in Arizona are talking about actually amending the Constitution of Arizona to eliminate corporate personhood in 2006. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, which was founded back in 1819, I think, by Jane Addams, it's had two Nobel Prize winners as its presidents. It was responsible in large part for the passage of women's suffrage, the right of women to vote, the 20th Amendment. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom has kicked, and WILF.org is their website, WILPF. Has kicked off a 3-year campaign to end corporate personhood. They've got these bumper stickers that say abolish corporate personhood that you can get on their website, and a whole educational campaign. POCLAD, the program on corporations, law, and democracy, is educating people. But beyond that, local communities are actually starting to stand up and say, hey, enough. The city of Point Arena, California, in 2000, passed a non-binding resolution, which wasn't law, but it's like helping to wake people up. I mean, that's always the first step, whether it was abolition or women's suffrage. It's first we have to wake people up. And they passed a resolution saying, we believe corporations aren't persons. In the meantime, now we have 10 communities in Pennsylvania and a couple of in a few other states, North Dakota, I think there's one in Wisconsin. But the 10 in Pennsylvania are the most visible, where the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF.org, CELDF, has actually passed laws. CELDF didn't pass the laws. The elected officials in these local communities have passed laws saying that corporations can't own farms. And they're doing this to keep out these giant agribiz, you know, giant hog farms and things. And of course, to say a corporation can't own a farm is to say a corporation isn't a person. And this is creating an enormous legal battle, which may well make it to the Supreme Court, which, you know, if enough communities around America do this, eventually the court will be given an opportunity to reverse its mistake, just as it did with women and with freed slaves. And so in the back of the book, and also on my website, we just put it there, anybody can download it, we hired CELDF's attorneys to look at the state constitutions of all 50 states and come up with an ordinance that a local town, township, county, community, unincorporated area can pass, that any local government can pass, saying, in our town, corporations are not persons. And it refers to the specific police powers acts within the constitution of each individual state that give the towns the right to do that. We additionally went through the constitutions of all 50 states and figured out where we need to insert the word natural before the word person in order to get corporations out of this business. And we are suggesting that the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States be amended to insert the word natural before the word person. And, you know, any one of those three things or a Supreme Court decision would be enough to change the tide. And so we're encouraging people to do all those things, because as with abolition and as with women's suffrage, it's not any one thing. It's a critical mass. And the first step, of course, is waking up as many people as possible. And the second is taking local and direct action. So the book is kind of a handbook, and the last third of the book is a handbook on how to do that. And like I said, on the website, which is unequalprotection.com, we've got all those laws right there. You know, you can just download them for free and print them out and turn it into a petition and get it on the city council agenda and, you know, roll with it. So.
All right, we only have a few minutes left. I don't know if we have enough time to. I wanted to ask you about if you saw any connections between the injustices that have you've recorded in your book and the current state we have right now, where the United States is threatening to up its ante in the war with Iraq.
Yeah, there's a chapter about that in the book, actually, you know, that goes back to Eisenhower's warning. Eisenhower pointed out that before World War II, we didn't have a defense industry in the United States. We had companies like General Motors that made cars, and in time of war they would switch over and make tanks, you know, but then after the war they would stop making the tanks. And once in the early 50s a permanent defense industry emerged, Eisenhower was very alarmed by this, and he said, we have to be very careful. We must, you know, never drop our vigilance that this industry doesn't gain so much power that it can influence government. I would suggest to you that the enormous oil profits and the enormous war profits to be made in the Middle East, while perhaps not the single largest driving force, although there are conspiracy theorists who claim that it is, I honestly don't know, is certainly a very powerful driving force for this Pax Americana, for the Pax, you know, American, what some people are referring to as American imperialism, that, you know, this new doctrine that was just released a week or two ago that essentially says what the Third Reich did, what the British Empire did in the 1700s, and what the Romans did 2,000 years ago is now going to be our policy. That the concept of corporate personhood and corporations having so much power that they can be the tail that wags the dog of government has not just something to do with that, but a lot to do with that. And again, we can fix that. You know, in biological systems, when you've got a single cell or a single part of an organism whose only value is growth, and it takes over the organism, that's called cancer. And that's what's happened in the body politic of America.
That was Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters in Seattle speaking with Tom Hartman, author of Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. In his interview, Hartman referred to a campaign initiated by the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom to abolish corporate personhood. Next, we'll hear from two women involved in that campaign. George King introduces the speakers.
This is a recording of Molly Morgan and Jan Edwards talking about abolishing corporate personhood. The presentation took place at the National Conference for Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on January 26, 2002. Jan Edwards and Molly Morgan both work with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Their workshop included the hidden history of how corporations came to have so much power, a chronology of how corporate personhood came to be, why this matters and what impact it has on democracy, and actions people can take to change the current situation. This segment features Molly Morgan.
Just as a brief introduction to what we're talking about with corporate personhood, I wanted to say a word about the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. For those of you who are not familiar with it, it's an organization that's been doing its work since 1915, when an original group of women suffragists on both sides of the pond were planning to meet at The Hague, and then World War I broke out. They met anyway and looked at the links between the war and between the women's oppression issues that they were looking at, and they've been doing their work in some 40 countries around the world ever since. And for the last 2.5 years, WILF has had a campaign called Challenging Corporate Power, Asserting the People's Rights. And we began with discussion information, and those of you who are interested in corporate power and democracy issues, all of the materials are available both by purchasing from print, the office in Philadelphia, as well as on our website, which is just wilpf.org. And you can download those and use those for discussion materials in groups, and different communities around the country have been doing that for the last couple of years. And as a result of those discussions that have been happening in both in WILF branches as well as with other organizations in different parts of the country, we've now focused on an action campaign that we just launched this past September, and it's the campaign to abolish corporate personhood. So that's what we're going to focus on today, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of context for the organization and the overall campaign that we're working on. It's a campaign that's going to go on for at least another 3.5 years in the organization in terms of direction that we're moving. So we've got a lot of good organizational support for it. So I'm going to begin by talking and giving an overview, and then Jan is going to talk both about the campaign that she did in Point Arena as well as talk about through the timeline. And we'll dive into discussion and questions after we get done with those things. So this thing called corporate personhood, when I was taking my cab to the airport in San Diego, I was talking to my taxi driver and telling him what I was coming here to do, and I said, you know, we think that corporations having the legal rights of persons is kind of crazy, and the cab driver said, yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. So it's a pretty obvious thing that people don't have too much trouble getting access to, but the reality is, as loopy as corporate personhood sounds, it is a real thing under the law, and it has a real impact on us as people as well as the possibilities for democracy. So it behooves us to understand what it is, how we got it, and what we can do to try to change it. So to start giving the information, what I'm going to do is go back to the Constitution and begin there. This was a document that was written in 1787 by 55 gentlemen who were cleverly described by one historian as the well-bred, the well-fed, the well-read, and the well-wed. They were some of the wealthiest, most privileged people in the brand new United States of America, and as such, they were highly aware that the property that they owned had everything to do with the amount of power that they had in the Americas. And this was, of course, the land they owned, the crops, the buildings they had, personal property and tools, and of course, their human property, the slaves that they owned as well. So since they were some of the best educated people on the planet, at least by European standards, they were also very aware that they knew a lot about democracy. And they also understood how much of a threat the real thing represented to the power and the privilege that they had. The kind of democracy that they prized and wrote about so eloquently could only be practiced by propertied white men like them, not by the rabble, or as Alexander Hamilton so finely referred to us, the mob at the gate. So when they sat down to write the Constitution, what they created was a document to protect property, not people. And not surprisingly, when they first released this document from 4 months in closed-door session, a lot of people howled. At least half of the people in the new country were very much opposed to the Constitution and worked to prevent its ratification because they had just fought this long revolutionary war and they were excited about liberty and freedom. They weren't excited about Congress and President and Supreme Court. But of course, the Federalists had not only a lot of money, but they had a very strong unity of purpose, and so they were successful in getting the Constitution ratified. But the Anti-Federalists were successful in that they made sure that there was a Bill of Rights attached to it, and that is really what is the part of the Constitution that's designed to protect people from the kinds of abuses that they saw would be possible under this new form of government. Now, it's worth noting that the Constitution does not anywhere include the word democracy, nowhere does it include the word slave or slavery, and nowhere does it include the word corporation. That's just a thing for you to hold on to. We'll come back to some of those things in a few minutes. But for right now, let's take a look at what the structure was that our illustrious founding fathers created. It's a pretty simple, direct structure. We have the sacred... Probably better if it was there, but it's not very complex, so if you can't see it, it's not a big problem. These sacred words that people for two centuries have been excited about, we the people are here, and under our system of government, theoretically, we the people are sovereign. That means the people are the rulers, and we have rights. And then on the other side of a line is the government. The government is accountable to we the people, and it has duties to perform under the Constitution. There's nothing wrong with this system on paper. This theory of representative democracy should work just fine. There's just one problem with it, and that is this phrase, we the people. At the time the Constitution was written, in order to be included in we the people, you had to be an adult male, you had to be white, and you had to have a certain amount of property. And what those things did was reduce we the people down to about 10% of the population. Those people who owned property, including those who owned human property in the form of slaves, were very clear that this was ruled by the minority, and that is exactly the way they wanted it. Whether they intended it benevolently or not, what they wanted was minority rule. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that the word corporation appears nowhere in the Constitution, and the reason for that is that the Founding Fathers had absolutely zero interest in having corporations having anything to do with their new form of government. In colonial times, corporations had been an instrument of the king, and they were used to shovel wealth from the so-called New World back into Europe. What they wanted was to exploit the riches that they found here. So corporations like the Hudson Bay Colony and the British East India Company and the Massachusetts Bay Colony, these were all corporations that had a lot of autonomy because they were far away from England. They could write laws, they could raise taxes, they could even raise armies if they needed whatever it took to manage property and commerce over in the Americas. So it may come as no surprise that with all that power, which they wielded with little impunity, they were not at all popular with the colonists. So when the Founding Fathers sat down to write the Constitution, they threw control of corporations to the state legislatures where they would get the greatest amount of supervision by the people. And the early corporate charters were very, very different from what they are today. The state legislatures took their responsibilities seriously. So when a group of investors came to the state legislatures and said, we want to form a corporation, they wrote down exactly what they could do, where they could do it, how they could do it, how long they could do it for, who they could do it with. Most of the charters only lasted about 10 or 15 years, and then they expired. The individual stockholders were all held personally liable for any kind of harm that was done in the name of the corporation. And most importantly, in order to receive these profit-making benefits that the investors sought, the corporation had to represent some kind of public good, like building a road or a bridge. So that was a very, very key component of it. And when corporations violated any of these rules of their charters, the state legislatures frequently revoked them and said, the rules are clear, you broke the rules, you're out of the pool. Well, the decades passed, and people's memory of this corporate institution of royal oppression started to fade, and the Industrial Revolution was rolling along. Increasingly, the wealthy people in this country started to see corporations as a pretty nifty way to shield their own private wealth. In addition, they could sniff the winds of change, and they could see that the amount of power that they had through their minority rule through property ownership was going to start to change. By the 1830s, women were already starting to publicly agitate for the right to vote. Horrors of horrors. In 1865, the 13th Amendment was passed, which freed the slaves, and then 3 years later, the 14th Amendment gave citizenship rights to those newly freed slaves. And so there was real change going afoot to this, we the people being only 10% of the population. So the ruling class responded. During and after the Civil War, corporations grew very rapidly in both size and in number. And they were increasingly becoming a very valuable way for people to protect power and property. What people started to do increasingly on behalf of corporations and through their corporate mouthpieces, they started to influence legislators and bribe public officials and employ lawyers who not only wrote new laws, but they challenged the existing laws in court. And so bit by bit, what the state legislatures started to do was increase corporate life length at the same time that they reduced corporate liability and they reduced citizen control over the production and the labor and all the structures that were in corporations. But that was a strategy, despite its real success through a number of decades, that was only going to be able to go just so far. And the reason for it is because corporations are created by the state legislatures, they're an instrument of government. That meant they fell on this side of the line with duties to the people, and they were accountable. So what they decided to do was to shift corporations from this side of the line to the other side so that they could have rights instead. And the tool that they used to do this turned out to be the 14th Amendment, which was passed in 1868. And from that year, it took the ruling class less than two decades to shift corporations from this government side of the line over to the we the people side. After a series of lower court cases, the Supreme Court heard a case in 1886 called Santa Clara County versus the Southern Pacific Railroad. The Supreme Court judges cited the 14th Amendment, and before they heard a single argument from either side of the case, they simply made a statement and said, "We believe that corporations are persons deserving the law's protection." That was it. There was no law passed in Congress. There was no kind of public debate. It was simple judicial fiat that said that's what the 14th Amendment means. Corporations can be included underneath that. Now, bear in mind that 1886 was a year when all women, all Native Americans, and even despite the laws after the Civil War, still most African American men didn't even have the right to vote. 10 years later, in 1896, in Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court established the separate but equal doctrine, which basically legalized racial segregation under what became known as Jim Crow laws. So what that means is that in less than 30 years, African Americans had effectively lost their personhood rights at the same time that corporations had acquired them. And in case you're still wondering whether the primary purpose of the Constitution is to protect property or people, listen to this. In the first 50 years after the 14th Amendment was ratified, less than one-half of 1% of the cases were about African Americans, and more than 50% of the Supreme Court cases were about corporations.
Based on the 14th Amendment.
Based on the 14th Amendment. So when you look at more than two centuries of accumulated the body of law that we've accumulated in the United States, what you see as a pattern is that people acquire rights under the Constitution by amendment, which, as many of you may know, is a difficult and long drawn out process, whereas corporations have acquired these rights by Supreme Court decisions, which requires five human beings to agree on what they want to do. Rights for corporations, because they're about property, are about who's going to be excluded, who can't play in this game. Rights for people are about who's going to be included. So once corporations had jumped over this line, then they proceeded to pursue the Bill of Rights through more Supreme Court cases. In 1893, they were assured Fifth Amendment protection of due process. In 1906, they got Fourth Amendment search and seizure protection. In 1925, it was freedom of the press and the speech. In 1976, the Supremes decided basically that money or spending money is equal to speech, and since corporate persons have First Amendment rights, then corporations can basically spend as much as they want on political candidates and on political parties. So we find ourselves in this time when corporations have amassed just enormous power and wealth, and a very significant reason that they can do that is because they masquerade as one of us. And most of us don't have a clue that that is what the reality is under the law and has been for a long time. And a key reason for this is that the whole thing is pretty esoteric. A corporation is what they call a legal fiction. It's just an abstraction. You cannot see or hear or touch or smell a corporation. All it is an idea, an agreement that people's lawyers sit down and put down on paper. But because they have the legal status of persons, it makes corporations like these superhumans. They have all the advantages that we could possibly have, plus more, and none of the disadvantages that we mere flesh and blood mortals have. So how are they like superhumans? Well, one of the things, as I mentioned before, their lifespans are now infinite. So corporations can exist forever and continue to amass wealth and power without having to deal with dying. You can cut off the arm or the leg or even the figurative head of a corporation, and it continues to exist. In court, lawyers either invoke personhood status or not, depending on the needs of the particular case. So it's like corporations are sort of these shape-shifting things. So they really have a lot of advantages over us. Now, along with this abstract kind of existence, corporations have also acquired a lot of abstract property. Land and buildings are still very important, but in addition to that, they have things like mineral rights and drilling rights, air pollution credits, intellectual property, and under NAFTA, corporations even have a right to a future profit. All of this abstraction is important to the way that minority control is maintained through property. When corporations were over here on the duties side of the line, the way that minority rule was achieved was to say that we, the people, could only include certain human beings. What that did was say, we the people are human, so all the rest of you, 90%, are some kind of subhuman things. But as the decades progressed and people didn't put up with that, they struggled and fought and eventually won their right to be included in the first three words of the Constitution. That tactic didn't work anymore. So what they did was jump corporations over. Now that everybody is a human, we're now going to make corporations superhuman so that we can still maintain this minority rule. So today, the work of these corporatists is to take this system global. Having acquired the ability to govern here in the United States, the corporation is the ideal instrument to gain control in the rest of the world. The concepts and the laws and the techniques that were perfected here in the United States by the ruling minority are now being forced down the throats of people all over the planet. First, a ruling or a complicit ruling elite is either co-opted or installed or propped up by the U.S. military and the United States government. And then, in the same way that slavery and immigrant status once kept wages either non-existent or at poverty levels. Now sweatshops and maquiladoras in the prison industrial complex continue to provide ultra-cheap labor with little or no regulation, in the same way that sharecropping and company store scrip were techniques that kept people in these permanently subservient production roles. Now the structural adjustment programs of the IMF and the World Bank keep entire countries in that kind of a role, the world's poorest people forced to feed these interest payments to the world's richest while their own children are going hungry. And just as genocide was used to destroy the indigenous populations that were living sustainably off the land, now wars are instigated against people and regimes who have the audacity to have their own ideas about what a government should be like and how they can accomplish resource distribution. Other techniques, all our favorites, racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, divisive religious and ethnic and ideological and cultural dividers have all been intentionally instituted to help keep the majority of people from making common cause against the ruling minority. And of course, those systems are all continuing their destructive impact today. Now, these systems of oppression didn't happen overnight. When you study the history, they happen just a little bit at a time in ways that people accept them because they're just gradual things and they start to seem normal. At the time of the Constitution, as I mentioned, corporations were widely reviled even by the wealthy, but a century later they were a common business form, and a century after that they've become our invisible government. Resistance to these oppressions happened in the same way. Those people who wished to end slavery, for example, spent a lot of time collecting information, refining their analysis, debating and discussing among themselves about what it was that was going on. What they came to understand was that the whole institution of slavery was one of human rights and that it was fundamentally wrong. When they realized that, they didn't come up with a slavery regulatory agency or voluntary codes of conduct for slave owners. They said the whole thing has got to go. They called themselves abolitionists. We're looking at corporate personhood the same way. When we look at how the system works, we see that it was, first of all, that it was wrongly given, not by we the people, but by 9 Supreme Court judges. And we see further that it is a bad thing because what corporate personhood allowed the system to do was to change an artificial entity into a thing that could become superhuman. It was the pivotal change that allowed it to jump that line. And finally, we see that corporate personhood is such a bad thing that we've got to get rid of the whole thing. Incremental change is not going to be adequate here. It's all got to go. Slavery is the legal fiction that a person is property. What corporate personhood is the legal fiction that property is a person. Like abolishing slavery, the work of ending corporate personhood takes us really to the deepest levels of what it means to be a human being. And if we're going to try to live in a democracy, what does it mean to be sovereign? The hardest part of this campaign to eliminate corporate personhood is believing that we actually have the right, if not the duty and responsibility, to do this. It comes down to us being very clear about who is in charge. So what would happen if we did abolish corporate personhood? Here are a few examples. If corporations did not any longer have the First Amendment right of free speech, we could prohibit all corporate political activity. We could say no more donations to any candidates, to any political parties. We could just wipe that out completely. Just think what a change it would be in our political system if we no longer had corporate money polluting our elections. Right now, corporate persons are protected against search without a warrant under the Fourth Amendment. What this means is that OSHA and the EPA and other regulatory agencies have to make an appointment if they want to go in and make an inspection and do it at a time that's convenient for the managers. So if you think the air or the water or the land in your community is being polluted or you think the workers are being mistreated, neither you nor the government has the right to walk in without permission or a warrant. So just imagine what we might be able to do if corporations were no longer shielded under the Constitution from polluting our communities. Without their protections under the Fifth and the 14th Amendments, corporations could be prevented from merging and from owning stock in other corporations. Again, if you haven't had a chance to study this particular aspect, it's astonishing the extent to which there are interlocking boards in terms of people being on multiple boards, the way these organizations are linked, even if they're not legally departments or divisions of each other. So we could get rid of all that. We could stop that from happening. We could leaflet in shopping malls. We could pass laws that prevented big chain stores like Walmart and Home Depot from coming into your community if you don't want them there. We could keep cell phone towers out of our community if we think they're ugly. We could organize openly at work. We could do a whole bunch of different things. There are just a lot of possibilities that open up if corporate personhood is eradicated. When slavery was outlawed, it didn't mean that life was better the next day for the people who had been slaves the day before. What happened was that it was the first step on what's turned out to be a very long and torturous journey, and one on which we still have a long way to go. But what abolishing slavery did was to change the fundamental power structure between the people who had been in control, people who basically ruled the country, and the group of people who had been abused by them the most brutally and the longest. Abolishing slavery ended the slaveocracy, and so it broke that whole institution so that this country could inch forward a little bit in its struggle toward democracy. Abolishing corporate personhood, we see, provides us with that same kind of possibility. If we eliminate the corporatocracy, it's an essential thing for us to change the fundamental power structure that we live with in this country and indeed on the planet. All the wealth and power that is accumulated in the hands of corporations is accessible to only a few people. In one of the earlier sessions today, one of the speakers made a comment about the majority of people in this country now owning some stock, which is true, but the majority of stock is still held by a very small percentage of people. So they're still the ones that are in control. Unmasking this fiction of legal corporate personhood is work that we think will help us all to better understand what citizen sovereignty means and what kinds of things we can do with it to eliminate minority rule once and for all. So that's what our focus is. We are working in this campaign as people who see a lot of really wonderful work that's gone on in this country, but basically it boils down to trying to eliminate one corporate harm at a time. Stopping those harms is important. It's good work, but as many of you probably know, it's exhausting, and one campaign can take years, burn out a lot of activists, use up scarce resources. What we're doing with this campaign is trying to focus at a deeper root level so that we change it at a fundamental place so that we can bust loose all this other stuff and try to really shift the power structure. So that's where we are with this whole thing. That is the overview, and now I'm going to let Jan continue on from there.
This is a recording of Molly Morgan and Jan Edwards talking about abolishing corporate personhood. The presentation took place at the National Conference for Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on January 26, 2002. Jan Edwards and Molly Morgan both work with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. This segment features Jan Edwards.
I should tell you all that Jan broke her leg on Christmas Eve, and you can make up any story you want about how she did that. But she's a tripper.
I've been saying I was beaten for my beliefs, but I actually was doing the laundry.
You believed it very strongly.
I believe strongly in clean clothes. When I went to get the cast on and then the cast off and then this thing on, I was talking to he's an orthopedic surgeon, a retired orthopedic surgeon. Now, I don't know anything about this man except that he's a retired orthopedic surgeon, okay? I suspect he's not an anarchist. But he asked what I was going to speak on, and I said, corporate personhood. And he didn't ask me what it was or anything. All I said, corporate personhood, and he said, "Don't you hate it when they say Enron has suffered?" He said, "I just hate it when they say Enron has suffered. Enron hasn't suffered. What about the employees of Enron? They've suffered." But he was just saying Enron hasn't suffered. They're just a piece of paper. And I thought, okay, basically that's my speech. But I felt that by talking to him and hearing him say that, that I was validated in feeling that the time is right and that all kinds of people feel this on a very deep level, that that Enron doesn't suffer.